Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on Dave Martell YouTube channel every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. We have a really great topic tonight we're going to talk about, but like always, we got to do our plugs, man. We got to do, if you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure to patreon.com/The Bog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, and most importantly, you get the RSS feed to listen to the audio of every single show that we do to listen to on your commutes, in your car, at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/The Bog. Go over, check it out. Help us keep the lights on. If you want to support The Bog another way, make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out the sweet merch we got over there. Winners here. We got hoodies. We got beanies. We got hats. We got all that good stuff. We got dresses for the ladies and onesies for the babies. All kinds of stuff over there at shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. So go over there and get some sweet merch and help support us and help us stay on the air. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out our boy Neil John. That is facebook.com/IronAgeJotish. That is Iron Age Jodish. Check it out for some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. The stuff is so super cool. Go over, give him a like. If you decide to get a reading, make sure to let him know that Big Dave sent you. Tell him I sent you over there and get yourself a reading. You know, that's good stuff over there. Also, last plug, Bizarre Archives, a cosmic horror double feature by A. Cuthbertson is out now. Go get yourself a copy, man. This thing rules. Go to thebizarrechives.com. That is thebizarrechives.com. And get yourself a copy. Two novellas from the eerie Englishman, A. Cuthbertson. Really, really great stuff. If you like things that are in the Lovecraftian cosmic horror tradition, these two short stories, they're not short stories, they're novellas. Two novellas, you're going to love them. They're great. Really, really good stuff. So go over to thebizarrechives.com and get yourself a copy. They're only $9.50 American, burger bucks. In English pounds, I believe that they're, it's like $7. So you get two great stories for under $10. You can't beat that. You can't get that anywhere. And they're great stories, too. Great price point. Great cover art. Great stories. This author, it's his debut. Go get yourself a copy. But speaking of Bizarre Archives and fiction and everything like that, we are going to talk about a really interesting topic tonight. We are going to talk about the mythopoetics of science fiction. And I know that might sound a little kind of kooky to some people out there that might, when they think of myth, or they think of the phrase mythopoetics, they're going to think about the Eddas. They're going to think about Homer and the Odyssey and the Iliad. They're going to think about Beowulf. They're going to think about King Arthur. They're going to think about just all of the epic poetry of the ancient world. That's going to come to their mind. So how in the heck could science fiction be mythopoetics? And we're going to get into that tonight. But my co-host, both of them are here, full panel. Tristan, Andre, what's going on, guys?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave.
I'm doing pretty good myself.
Excellent. So let's start it out. Our boy Tristan he knows all about this. He's a big brain on this topic. So Tristan, can you give us a definition on what mythopoetics is? What does it mean?
Sure. So mythopoetics is basically just a very fancy word of saying something that pertains to the primordial creation of myths in human thought. It really refers to a sort of sociological theory advocated by Henry Frankfurt and his wife, that they believed that at some point in human development, that humans used to believe in, instead of universal laws like scientific inquiry and a mechanical material understanding of the universe, people perceived everything as effectively some sort of will or motive, or especially a person was behind it. And because of this, it gave rise to myths and religious thought is what their theory goes. But when talking about it in a narrative term, like the mythopoetics of science fiction, that we really have to understand it as being something that's conducive to or allows one to allude to the actual myths of human creation. For instance, Lord of the Rings is often termed a very mythopoetic fiction, because even though it's totally a fantasy element, it refers to different mythic structures. It brings the idea, the implication of myth in human thought that, for instance, Eru Iluvatar in Lord of the Rings has created the world, and there's all the grand heroism, and there's a will and a fate and a struggle against cosmic evil and goodness and all these other things that are absent from general conceptions of a scientific materialistic universe. And other fictional narratives that present similar things like that are generally referred to as mythopoetic in their nature.
So mythopoeticism is effectively demonstrating through prose something that would be like an eternal living truth, a primordial truth, right?
More or less, yes. It's anything that would relate to a sort of the mythic thought process of a religious structure. Anything that could be seen as concerned with a divinity or fate or magic or anything of that sort of thing that has some sort of meaning behind it beyond just the material.
Yeah. So what we're going to talk about tonight is whether or not modern storytelling, and most specifically science fiction, is mythopoetic in nature. Now, mythopoetics, like I said earlier, when you think of mythopoetics, you think of the things that I mentioned before. You're thinking of, you know, Beowulf. You're thinking of the Eddas. You're thinking about stories of the gods and the creation of man, the creation of worlds, and, you know, all of this, the Voluspa, and like these kinds of sagas and tales and poetry, more specifically. And when you hear poetry, we think of something that rhymes, right? We think of just something that. Poetry in itself isn't necessarily just something that rhymes. Poetry is words, prose, that is given meter and meaning through its structure, right? It's a way to convey these things in a... It's like consecrating words to give them value and give them... to make them whole and to make them holy by ordering them in a specific way. So when we talk about mythopoetics, we are talking about, as Tristan mentioned, stories that have greater significance than what is just on, like, at face value, right? Something that is significant in a way, like to mankind's eschatology, how mankind is born, how the world is born, or mankind's judgment or doom or end, like the apocalypse or whatever. That's anything that has some sort of greater significance or nuance of that nature to the story could be considered mythopoetic. Now, to us in modernity, we sort of just apply that to anything that's old. In order for it to be mythopoetic, it has to be old. It has to be from the ancient world. And this is not necessarily true, at least in my summation. I argue that really good fiction, and for us specifically science fiction, not all, but some of it that's really, really good, does have either mythopoetic qualities or is in itself mythopoetic. Mr. Andre, what do you think about that?
No, I think what you're saying here is it's correct in that it has had to have like these different elements that kind of, in a way, it echoes with what we know, what we're familiar with. Even for people who might not be entirely too familiar with the great poems and epics of bygone ages and so forth, they still have a recollection of a structure that's very similar at times to these old stories. It can be the structure of the story itself, or it can be the message, I think. In a way, I would also think that something like your fantasy and science fiction archetypes, some of them are almost directly taken from the mythopoetic sphere. The idea of the archetypical hero, for instance, that's something that you see in pretty much any grand type of literature. And the hero character can be prominent in many types. Like, we think of the hero in Lord of the Rings being someone like Aragorn or Frodo being subverting a little bit of expectations. But if you look at certain science fiction works of science fiction, you can find a lot of different types of heroes that follow the same kind of pattern and path that these usually take.
Yeah, and I would also argue, and this is what I actually said this last night, I did a Mythopoetics of Cosmic Horror talk on the Bizarchives channel, and we talked about that. And what I said was effectively the reason that I would argue that science fiction is specifically has mythopoetic qualities more so than, say, even like something like fantasy, even though fantasy is, like, Tolkien is the mythopoetic, you know, saga written in modern times. But I would say as a genre, for us, science fiction has more mythopoetic qualities for this reason. As Tristan said, it has to do with our creation, or it has significance insofar as our doom, right? Because those are the two parts of eschatology: your doom, your death, your afterlife, you know, your birth, your rebirth, the creation, so on and so forth. The cycle of existence is what eschatology is, and that's what mythopoeticism is outlining. So this is my argument for why certain, not all science fiction, and there's certain science fiction that I would completely exclude from this discussion. For example, what I would call progressive science fiction, stuff like Star Trek, where the future is great, and it's pretty much just expanding, you know, good guy, you know, whatever, and they're just learning and blah, blah, blah. And there's no real, like, in looming consequences to the universe itself. Obviously, in Star Trek, they run into races that are aggressive. There are certain events and circumstances that come, like, to cataclysmic you know, possibilities. But as a whole, it's not really woven into the world of Star Trek. The point of Star Trek is kind of like this technophile white pill, and that's about it. So I would exclude stuff like Star Trek. To me, the stuff that really has mythopoetic qualities is that which really holds the flame of science fiction as a storytelling tradition, and that is that little bit of that science fiction is a warning. Science fiction, at least in my view, really good, true, pure science fiction is a warning of technology. It is about man's anxiety and concern about what could possibly happen in the future with his relation with technology. And what I said last night was I was talking about ancient peoples and how they viewed their mythopoetic. To them, their mythopoetics was very much concerned with the past. They were very much concerned with the creation of the worlds and trying to figure out the worlds and the creation of themselves and so on and so forth. They wanted to know where they came from. They wanted to know. They did know. You know, they understood this. And this, but this is where they were concerned with. Whereas we are concerned more with the future, not necessarily because it's a good thing, not necessarily because our ancestors were wrong. And I would actually argue in some fashion we are wrong, because I think that we're less concerned with the past because science has given us this false sense of security that we already know what happened in the past. We have measured it, we've studied it, we know everything about it. But because of our experience in modernity, which we do not share with our ancestors, which is the rapid evolution of technology, if you think about it, in the ancient world, they would go for centuries and centuries where things just were pretty much the same. Life was pretty much the same. If somebody in, you know, we're talking, we'll say 100 BC ran into somebody from 500 AD, their lives would not be really that alien to one another. You know what I mean? Obviously, in some of the beliefs and worldviews and conversions and, you know, so on and so forth, that would have been different. But as far as the practical existence of everyday-to-day life is, it would have been like, okay, I know what's going on here. I understand this. We farm, we do this, blah, blah, blah. These people are in charge. You know, so, this is how you use this tool, blah, blah, blah. To us, in the last 100 years, let's say from 1920 until now, it has rapidly changed so quickly that we have this inborn innate anxiety about where this could be going. And this has been happening for the last 100 years. True sci-fi, I would say, did... Obviously, sci-fi started in the late 1800s, but it really became a thing in the 1920s. It really came into its own, because that was when electricity started being invented. That is when the telephone started to become commonplace. This is where all of the country was connected via railways. Airplanes were starting to be invented. This was the industrial age, right? And from that point, we went from railways and the beginning of electricity and telegraphs and stuff like that, to now we literally have smartphones in our hands, and we are coming up on some pretty crazy stuff like gene editing and so on and so forth. So the reason that it's mythopoetic to us is because not so much that it's concerned with science fiction is concerned with our origins as it is concerned with our doom. So that's why I would argue that science fiction as a genre, at least some, and we're going to go over some subgenres that I believe are deserve to be mentioned in the mythopoetic conversation, is indeed mythopoetic. What do you think about that, Tristan? Sorry for the big long rant.
Oh, no, it's perfectly fine. I was going to say that, actually, I think that I will take a bit of a different tack here and say that, well, I would agree that science fiction can, in fact, be and frequently is mythopoetic in its nature. It's less of a binary choice of whether it is or isn't, and it's more a matter of intensity. And I would say that as a matter of intensity, the fantasy genre is just more mythopoetic than the science fiction genre all up. And that's because, as you've mentioned, for most of human history, life was more or less relatively the same. And I would even go further than 100 BC to 500 AD and say that the basic life structure of someone from 10,000 years ago to, like, I don't know, maybe the 1700s was more or less identical. They could fairly well get by and figure out what they were doing with each other. And this creates a certain pattern in human thought and behavior, so that what's deeply and heartfelt meaningfully to us is effectively things that are conventionally staples of the fantasy genre. It's swords and heroism and feudalism and knights and hierarchy and structures and farming and wilderness and horses and travel and all these other things that we would traditionally ascribe to the fantasy genre. And while you can relay aspects of that into science fiction, for instance, a laser gun battle between a hero and a villain is just as mythopoetic as it is a sword fight. The sword fight is more mythopoetic because it's generally recognized as more deeply meaningful, whereas the laser gun battle is effectively just calling, like, alluding to a more mythological staple from the past. So, actually, there's a unique thing we'll talk about, segue into our discussion of the genres of science fiction, that fantasy elements within science fiction are actually rather prominent, and that's because as you try and meaningfully try to work in mythopoetic themes into any sort of story that makes it deeply meaningful to humanity, you start progressing further and further towards a sort of fantasy outlook, and you end up with what's called science fantasy instead of science fiction. And this is encompasses works such as Dune or Star Wars or Warhammer 40,000, where it's very clearly set in a future space-oriented scientific setting and all that, but it has elements of immaterial, the immaterial past. It has magic and sword fights and melee weapons and all these other things that are callbacks to an earlier time in humanity's history.
So, effectively, what I'm alluding to is that I do not think necessarily that mythopoetics has to only be shooting backwards. I think that there is a form of mythopoetics that shoots forward, right? That is prophetic in nature, right? If it's How can I explain this? Tristan, you understand what I'm trying to say here?
No, I perfectly understand what you're saying here. I don't necessarily disagree. I just think that as a matter of intensity, something that relates to scenarios in which humanity has lived in a longer sphere and has much more interaction with is more deeply meaningful. That even if you progress it into like a future scenario with technology and whatnot, it doesn't lose the situation of being mythopoetic, but it's just a less intense version of it. It's alluding to the other more deeply meaningful version of mythopoeia.
And before we kind of go into a little bit of overview of some of the subgenres that we would consider mythopoetic, Mr. Andre, do you have something you'd like to add?
The only thing I would like to add here is that when it comes to what aspect and how to the degree, if it's not, or if, as Tristan mentioned, that there is intensity to it. For those who are not necessarily in the know, when you're talking about science fiction usually comes in a scope, in a spectrum between hard science fiction and soft science fiction.
Yeah.
And this is usually where you can see the intensity, because hard science fiction usually tend to heavily focus on the science part and soft science fiction on the fiction part. In soft science fiction, you're talking about things like Star Wars. Science doesn't really mean much. It's more like a backdrop. But if you're talking about hard science fiction, you're talking about the nitty-gritty mechanical details about the problems of landing a spaceship on Mars due to Martian gravity being different from Earth, which can be incredibly tedious and doesn't contain a lot of the mythic elements that we might be looking for or that we might be considering. Well, the soft one is definitely leaning more heavily towards that.
And you know what? Actually, I think one of the primary elements here is that hard science fiction tends to have deep meanings and themes to it, but they tend to be very modern sociological commentaries about what the author believes should be going on in this society about, say, racism or inequality or economics or some, you know, various things like this. But these are meaningful deep in a narrative term, in that they have implications to the story beyond what is immediately obvious, but they're not meaningful to humanity in the same way that the struggle between good and evil is.
Now, actually, I'm gonna actually disagree with this, and we're gonna get into that a little bit. But I want to kind of move into the genres of sci-fi, kind of give them an overview, talk about what they are, what they mean, what goes into them, and then whether or not they have mythopoetic elements. So let's start with kind of the primordial science fiction. And I would say obviously there was some works that came out before this, but I would say that Sword and Planet is the original science fiction kind of work. Mr. Tristan, are you familiar with this genre?
I am, though. Generally speaking, I would refer to it as like a space opera, but Sword and Planet is a very good take on it.
So I would actually say that there's a difference between Sword and Planet and space opera, but to give a brief overview of Sword and Planet effectively started with Edgar Rice Burroughs' Barsoom series, John Carter of Mars, with Princess of Mars, Priest of Mars, Warlord of Mars, so on and so forth, and that kicked off a whole litany of stories and stuff throughout the entirety of the pulp phenomenon. Right, you had guys that were, you know, wielding swords on other planets with blue Martians, and you know, all kinds of crazy stuff with the spaceships that are shaped like zeppelins, and it was it's a really beautiful aesthetic genre that has a lot of really cool art associated with it. However, outside of this is just a kind of retelling of ancient mythic stories, it's not really a philosophically meaningful genre. It's cool and it's fun and it's entertaining and all that stuff, but as Tristan and Andre mentioned before, it's sort of just fantasy with sci-fi elements, right? So outside of that, what kind of cross-pollinates with, as Tristan mentioned, is the space opera. Now, the space opera is different than Sword and Planet in that Sword and Planet is just these are the elements that go into it. Space opera implies something of very large scope. It implies fantasy style or Game of Thrones style. Think Star Wars, think Dune, think anything that's like that. Like bunch of factions and kingdoms all going warring together, so on and so forth. But I would still say that the space opera is very much a fantasy style story. Would you agree with those takes, Tristan?
Oh, I absolutely would. I mean, I think Star Wars is probably the preeminent space opera in modern times that everyone's familiar with. And it's a good example to use to characterize what we mean by it. Star Wars is a space opera because the fundamental actions that are going on here, even though they're on starships and it's, you know, thousands and thousands of years. Actually, I think it's in the past, but, you know, it's more or less in the future.
Yeah.
And with aliens and whatnot and all this technology, it centers around what is effectively a group of, like, space wizards with, like, laser swords. Yeah. It's very easy that these people are literally knights.
Yeah. Andre?
No, I think I agree here. I don't have anything to add, honestly.
Yeah. So, Tristan, what elements of, say, let's just talk Star Wars because that everybody knows about Star Wars. What about Star Wars is mythopoetic?
Well, I mean, the things about Star Wars that are mythopoetic are, for instance, the instance of personal heroism. For instance, the Jedi often fight personally in wars and struggles and against oppression. They do so not through, like, subversive of underhanded means. They're not hackers. They're not cunning people with grand and intricate political plots. Effectively, what happens is they use their personal puissance and power to effect great change in society. And this is a normal heroic theme for any sort of heroism. But there's also a deeper layer here, which is a philosophical struggle in the Star Wars setting between what is effectively good and evil. There's, you know, the Sith and the Jedi represent the dark and the light sides of the Force. And within these, they have not only a philosophical framework about reality, but one that's quasi-religious. They want different things for reality and humanity and just society in general. And this is engaged in an actual physical, but not only a physical, a metaphysical struggle between them over the dominance of the world and the universe.
And would you say Dune is of the same quality?
Dune is very much of the same quality, though I would say it's much more complicated because Dune has a lot of very complex sociological commentary that ties into modern times and also is much more involved with political shenanigans than Star Wars is. Star Wars is very basic. You know, it's the hero smacks the person that they don't like in the head with a laser sword, whereas Dune is very much in the sense of this grand revelatory religious figure has been developed through some what amounts to effectively prophecy, and he leads humanity to rediscover ideals and values and behaviors through his own guiding light.
And Andre, would you say that Warhammer 40K would fall into a mythopoetic space opera?
Warhammer is an incredibly mythopoetic type of science fiction. And it has a lot of different layers that add to that. You're talking about the universe where, for instance, in Star Wars, you have this vague kind of idea that, for instance, the Jedi have innate spiritual powers, but somebody don't know really where it comes from. Maybe it's what they did in the prequels and said that it's some sort of genetic thing or whatever, but it's left mysterious. Warhammer 40,000, flat on the face, just says gods are real. Gods exist. There is a parallel universe to ours where these beings dwell, and they can influence our world. And there are both good and bad forces out there that are in a constant battle for the possession of the sentient beings in the galaxy's soul, primarily humans. And humans, much like they have in Dune, have also created themselves a legendary mythical figure to support them and help them that has slowly but certainly, maybe due to prophecy or maybe due to fate or maybe due to something else, have more or less ascended or has fully ascended, it's left kind of ambiguous, to a god. And this being keeps people safe. It physically battles these chaotic entities called gods. It's a much grander scale than Star Wars, and it's less grounded in science in that sense. Sure, in Star Wars, science is very much a backdrop. In 40K, it's even more of a backdrop, especially since most science in 40K is also incredibly backwards.
So, you guys mentioned a few minutes ago about how you would consider hard sci-fi to not be mythopoetic. I would disagree. I would actually say that it's more mythopoetic, hard sci-fi. Now, there is some hard sci-fi that I would not throw into this list. And speaking of space operas, a hard sci-fi space opera that I would completely exclude from the conversation of mythopoetics would be Isaac Asimov's Foundation series. I do not think that Foundation has mythopoetic elements. I actually think that Foundation, even though it was kind of the first space opera, I actually don't even really like it, to be honest. I don't think it's and to be fair, I didn't read all of it. I read some of the first book, and I was not really a big fan. He does a really great job world building, does a really great job kind of creating fictional technology and so on and so forth. But in my summation, there's not really a whole lot of meaningful philosophical underpinnings outside of here's all these different people. Let's all work to do kumbaya and find peace and like it's like it's literally just multiculturalist power fantasy. That's like really all that it is. It's just like some hippy dippy liberal kind of stuff. Are you guys familiar with the Foundation?
I'm vaguely familiar with it, though I've actually wanted to the TV show that's actually come out. I've yet to actually watch it, but I've been waiting to do so. Though actually, to use an example for hard science fiction, I was actually going to bring up another work of Asimov's that I'm more familiar with, which is I, Robot.
Sure.
I would categorize it as effectively what you've said. It's not a whole lot of deeply meaningful thought going into it. It's primarily a sociological commentary where the author has decided upon a set philosophy, and it's not even so much an exploration of this philosophy in actual meaningful terms so much as it's just a bunch of settings and situations arranged so as to allow them to propagandize using that philosophy.
Yeah, that's all that it is. And unfortunately, a lot of modern sci-fi period does this. I would argue that Star Trek started this theme. Gene Roddenberry is a democratic socialist kind of guy, and he very much just put forth this presupposition that his idea of a peaceful multicultural future is the best thing ever, and that's what they're going to work towards. So it doesn't really have much. There are like individual episodes that have some kinds of meaningful philosophical things, but as a whole, I would say that it is I don't want to say bad about it, because there's a lot of people that really like it, and it is considered a science fiction, pillar of science fiction, but I would throw Star Trek into that.
Right. For what it's worth, I actually quite personally really like Star Trek. And I would say that even though it started as effectively a propaganda tool for Roddenberry's own philosophical outlook and beliefs, especially once you get up to like The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine, it starts to evolve very contrary to his original visions, much to the chagrin of some segment of the fans. And they started to explore different concepts like what if maybe the Federation was wrong, or what about its implications of how the Federation lives and believes and works that is actually kind of contrary to the original perception of them and presentation of them. And that, these things are actually canon evidence that people in setting have to struggle with themselves and deal with. Deep Space Nine effectively is a subversion of the entire original concept of Star Trek. It is effectively much more mythopoetic in that sense. Straight up to the point where the main character, the captain of the space station, as it were, eventually becomes a religious prophet himself.
Go ahead, Andre.
In a way, when it comes to things like hard science fiction, I think it mainly falls on the spectrum of not really being mythopoetic, usually because they tend to focus heavily, as you said, either on technology or some sort of social ill or social wrong that they perceive based on their own opinions and convictions. And there might be some vague philosophical backgrounds, but usually hard science fiction either sees technology as a method of solving said social ill that they see, or they see it as a opponent that needs to be defeated in order for this ideal that they have to come forth. In a way, hard science fiction tend to play very safe on the philosophical, in that they don't usually involve a lot of things that could be interpreted as myth or anything like that, and instead focus more on a more materialistic way that, you know, the old world is dead. Religion is gone. Philosophy is materialistic, and it's through materialism and science that we can achieve this, you know, quote-unquote enlightenment to these issues that I perceive as the author.
Yeah, I would agree to a lot of that. However, I disagree in that hard sci-fi, at least the way that it's supposed to be portrayed, which is, if you go and you read the original kind of hard sci-fi stuff, we're talking, you know, all the stuff that appeared in the old pulps, where you had mad scientists leading society off the rails, interacting with entities or beings or various things that are, you know, leading mankind to their doom. There's hard sci-fi is very much it's earthbound. It has to do with man's trajectory into his own demise. It's and I think in that sense that it is very mythopoetic, and this kind of goes into what I feel is probably the truest and purest kind of evolution of science fiction, which would be cyberpunk. I would say cyberpunk is like the rightful heir of the science fiction genre, and I would say that certain works of cyberpunk are mythopoetic, insofar as it completely has to do with mankind's struggle with evil. It has to do with man creating his own doom. It has to do with man leading to his own demise. It has to do with, in some cases, really like kind of prophetic predictions about the direction of society, the direction of humanity going towards his doom and stuff like that. For example, nobody in a million years would say that the Voluspa is not mythopoetic. That is 100. That is a myth, right? What is half of Voluspa? It's about Ragnarok. It's about the prophecy. It's a prophecy of the Cirrus. That's what Voluspa literally means. So when we talk about cyberpunk being prophetic, having these kind of abilities to predict things and talk about man's struggle with kind of external evil being you know, just the direction that things go, I would say that cyberpunk, not all cyberpunk, a lot of cyberpunk now, unfortunately, when you get away from the source documents, the source works of cyberpunk, you get into just kind of like meaningless nonsense, right? You get into holographic hookers and nanobot drugs and you know, trannies with mohawks and like just nonsense, right? It's just they took the aesthetics. What, like with anything, they do this with everything. They take the aesthetics, they leave behind the meaningful philosophical underpinnings, and they just turn it into crap, which is what cyberpunk has kind of turned into. But if you look at the original works, being Neuromancer, being Snow Crash, these two stories have influenced people today probably more than any theoretical, political, philosophical works you can imagine. We're talking everybody from Bezos, Zuckerberg, all of the technocrats. You know, in fact, many of them have said they're developing the stuff that they're developing because they were obsessed with Snow Crash. They were obsessed with Neuromancer. These had huge impacts on these guys. And it's not because these works celebrated these futures. They were a warning against these futures. And these people, being the psychopaths they are, look at these warnings, and they're like, oh, man, I got to create that, instead of, oh, no, like, this is a warning. We need to avoid this at all costs. What would you, Mr. Tristan, what do you think about what do you think about that there?
I would largely agree with you there. I think it's fair to delineate hard science fiction between effectively science fiction that deals with humanity and the nature of what it is to be human, and the sort of science fiction that deals with basically just a backdrop for all the cool gadgets and gizmos that they can come up with as a sort of a glorifying scientistic idea of them. Which is exactly what you say with going into cyberpunk, which is primarily the genre that focuses upon humanity and its relation to what is humanity itself. It struggles with technology and society and goes into ideas about what it is to be human and what the nature of humans even are. And that's exactly what you were saying with how they basically just take these things because they are themselves the victims of the sort of detachment from humanity and meaning and victims of society that the original cyberpunk were wanting to explore and warn about. And they create a sort of scientistic gadgets and gizmos sort of viewpoint of cyberpunk effectively because they don't understand that it's supposed to be a warning, that it's, they don't understand the deep meanings behind it because they're the victims thereof.
So, and you mentioned it's about man's struggle with his humanity, man trying to understand what humanity is and what happens when man relinquishes his humanity. How many stories do we see in the ancient texts that have to do with that exact same thing? Man selling his soul, or making a deal with something evil, or so on and so on. It's like the same exact thing, but instead, this is why a lot of cyberpunk is like really good. And I the only type of punk genre that I think is legitimate is cyberpunk. I want to put that out there. Steampunk is not a real genre. It's just an aesthetic. It's not real. I couldn't name a single important steampunk work off the top of, and then I could name probably 30 cyberpunk works that are of.
No, I think you nailed it there. In that steampunk really isn't a genre. It's exactly what, as you said, it's an aesthetic that you attach to some other sort of fantasy work.
Yeah, and for that reason, I really dislike steampunk. I think it's corny. But going back to cyberpunk doesn't. It's not like Asimov, and I'm not knocking on Asimov. Asimov was an incredible writer, and he wrote a lot of great stuff despite some of his hippy-dippy liberal crap, right? But cyberpunk, technology in cyberpunk isn't necessarily about the technology. It's about, it is a stand-in for the metaphysical evil that they struggle with in the ancient stories, instead of demons, or instead of Jotun, or instead of the Titans, it's corporations, it's the looming conception and the lure and the seduction behind technology. Technology in cyberpunk is not necessarily about the machines themselves. It's about the conception. and technology in cyberpunk is a metaphysical force against mankind, and it's about mankind's struggle of against that force. You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I would completely agree with you there. It's better to say that technology in a cyberpunk setting is effectively just used to heighten the awareness of the general public towards what is effectively the metaphysical agencies going on there by giving them something that they're less familiar with so that it's more stark when they look at it. It's easier to say that a mega corporation as Tekka United is, you know, grinding people down between her heel and forcing them to do all this weird stuff, right, that you would have in a cyberpunk book, than it is to present like Walmart, because people are used to Walmart and what Walmart does. So when you present that to people, it doesn't shock them into any sort of action. It's just normal. They ignore it. They think of it as relative to themselves. But when you give it a fictional outlook like that's different enough to them that they can regard it as alien and the other.
Yeah,
it forces them to question the basis of what's going on its own terms.
And another thing that I would say is mythopoetic about, and this is a little bit kind of offbeat, but this it just reminds me, when I read cyberpunk, I very much feel like I'm reading some kind of, I feel, not that I'm reading Voluspa, because that's like a sacred text, but something with a similar format, because cyberpunk, a lot of times, it starts out with this origin story, right? Except it's like further down the timeline. It's like the second, it's like, in the year 2000 and whatever, this was invented, and because of this, mankind was born out, and then it's like, you know, like this city came out and they began to become these cybernetic people, or this is when life all changed, or what. It almost has like an origin story to it. And then this origin story turns into this prophecy. And then so many of these books, William Gibson, for example, Neuromancer is like the OG. But William Gibson had a couple other books. One of them was called Virtual Light, and another one was called Erudo, or something. And I can't remember which is which. This is just off the top of my head. It's been years since I read these. But one of them, the protagonist in the story, which I actually believe his name is Protagonist. It was like Hero Protagonist, which is, yeah, H-I-R-O, which is like a silly name. But, or maybe that was in Snowcrash. I read like all these books back-to-back years ago, so they kind of blend together a little bit. But in this story, it talks about, you know, mankind, not necessarily starts out their origin, but because of these certain technological developments, a new humanity was born. And then they go on this new timeline towards their doom. And one of the characters actually begins to predict it, and he predicts the end times. And what he does is he puts together like these nodes. I forget what he calls them in the story. There's a lot of like, you know, made up lingo in there, but it's about how he puts these like these data points together and is able to predict certain outcomes and happenings. And he pretty much talks about how he has proven fate. He can measure fate, and he can predict things by looking at these nodes of intersecting circumstances that he can calculate. And because of that, he says there's now, I could see the apocalypse effectively. So there is like all of the elements that go into these ancient mythopoetic stories, not all of them and all the time, but a lot of times are found in cyberpunk. And why I think that cyberpunk is so significant isn't just like it's a retelling of an ancient story. These are stories that are an ancient, like a retelling of ancient story, but they also have forward-looking, real-life, practical, like, prophecy in them. Like, they really are predicting certain things. Like, they predict, like, William Gibson predicted the internet. Like, he knew that what the internet was going to look like. He used different lingo for it and stuff like that. Things like virtual reality were predicted. We're talking, you know, gene editing was predicted. They predicted, like, pretty much everything that we're seeing happening now in the technocrat, among the technocrats and so on and so forth, they predicted, right? They said that this was going to happen. So not only does it have this retelling, this format of the ancient stories, it also has this prophetic element to it.
I think that's rather interesting that you say that it has a prophetic element. I generally say that that's less of a prophecy so much as it is just a material analysis of culture. But I do see where you're coming from that, and it's definitely worth discussing and worth considering as an element going into it.
And what do you think, Andre?
I haven't really thought about it much, but now that you put it the way that you did, that makes a lot of sense. Because honestly, a lot of the cyberpunk that you see, especially at least the good ones, they tend to follow the same type of pattern that you mentioned, and they usually come to the same kind of prophetic conclusions. Usually they are able to predict at least some, if not a lot, of different things that we see in the current age. Except usually they're taken to the extreme, but if you just look at, not to just get all super grim or anything like that, if you look at how things have progressed in the last decade or so, things have increased exponentially in the direction of a lot of cyberpunk, or at least what the cyberpunk genres have predicted what would happen with the control of internet, or the invention of the internet, or the idea of virtual reality, or the time-honored classic of the mega corporations taking over the roles of things like government and so forth.
Yeah, you know, I remember reading some of these cyberpunk stories, and I'm like, man, these like the corpos, right? The corpos. These like corporations and the CEOs of these corporations, these evil guys, you could just like switch them out for Sauron, right? It's really incredible. Like,
but you know, there's actually an element of Sauron canonically that he is effectively a modernizing corporate entity. It goes into the industrialization and the scouring of the Shire. The orcs are themselves an industrializing force that is progressing beyond the medieval world of the Western noble peoples.
Mythopoetic. So, I would say, like, because we're up on an hour already. So, I would say...
Yeah, we're pretty much hitting the limit.
Yeah, wow. So, we were worried that this was not going to be long enough. But anyway, so I would say, in conclusion, that I believe that these things... And I would say this as well, speaking of one last point on cyberpunk. We don't know whether or not that the cyberpunk authors wrote these things as predictions, or they wrote them and then so many people were inspired by them that they created these horrible dystopias that they envisioned. So if these cyberpunk books like Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, or William B. Gibson's Neuromancer, or Virtual Light, we don't know if they predicted these or if people picked them up and were inspired to create the dystopias, meaning that they are like self-fulfilling prophecies, which I would say is pretty mythopoetic. So, in conclusion, Tristan, did I convince you on the mythopoetic nature of science fiction?
You know, I would have to say that I think you pretty much did. I would say that, most of science fiction can be called mythopoetic, and effectively my position just falls back into the intensity argument that I was going with earlier.
Yeah, I'll take that. And what about you, Andre? Did I convince you?
I have to agree with Tristan on this. Like, you more or less convinced me of things I haven't really thought that much about when it came to things like science fiction, but as Tristan said, it's more about the intensity of it, and I guess it also boils down to the fact that as any type of genre in fiction or whatever like that, there's a lot of just bland and uninspired tat out there that doesn't have any sort of meaning, but you need to look past and look at the works that really have meaning. And with those works that do have meaning, I do think you make a very good point.
Excellent. Hell yeah. So you guys out there that maybe that are new to this kind of stuff, give it a shot and see if you agree. See if you find these mythopoetic elements in science fiction. Because I don't like the idea that myth is forever trapped in stasis of the ancient world. I believe that myth is a living truth. I believe that it is a living thing, and that that every, not every, but most generations write their own continuation of the myth, the continuation, the continuity of the storytelling tradition, the mythopoetic tradition, takes different forms and is reflects the our folk in the time that they write it. Not necessarily that it's better or needs to supersede any of the original stuff. The original stuff is the most important forever, right? But we have our own pages that we write down, that our own myths that we create that are important for our time. And to us, like, I disagree with this idea that fiction is just meaningless entertainment. I find that fiction is our version of the storytelling tradition, at least the good stuff and some of it. Some of the really good stuff is. Most of it's not. But I think that in these days, we look back at the ancient stuff and we're like, man, that was the best stuff ever. Our stuff is just crap. But who knows? In 3, 4, 5 centuries or whatever, somebody might pick up a copy of Neuromancer or pick up a copy of, Edgar Rice Burroughs, or pick up a copy of Lord of the Rings or Dune, or who knows, maybe even the Bizarre Archives, right? And they read it, and it really just blows them away with the elements that they see in there that have to do with the very, very old stuff. So that's what I would like to say in conclusion. And we are out of time, folks, unfortunately. So I hope you guys like this episode here. If you want to listen to it on audio and support the Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, so on and so forth. But most importantly, you get the RSS feed to listen to the audio of every single show that we do, to listen to on your commutes, in your car, at your job, or at work, or at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/thebog. Go sign up. Help us keep the lights on. If you want to support the Bog another way, make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and get yourself some sweet Bog merch, man. We got hoodies. We got beanies. We got all kinds of stuff for the winter season. But you can find whatever you want there. Hats, all kinds of stuff. Dresses for the ladies. Onesies for the babies. Go check it out. shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. You want to support one of our friends, make sure you go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. The stuff is so super cool, man. Go give him a like. Go see what he's doing over there. If you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. That's facebook.com/ironagejodish. Guys, get yourself a copy of the Cosmic Horror Double Feature. This thing rules. This thing is great. You know, it's Mr. Cuthbertson's debut story. It's two stories in one for the price of under $10. $9.50 burger bucks. It's like $7 English pounds. You can't beat that price. And the stories are just tremendous. So if you like Lovecraft and you like spooky stuff and you like cosmic horror, go get yourself a copy of Bizarre Archives Presents a Cosmic Horror Double Feature, Dredge and Prestwick's Project. Really cool stuff over at thebizarrearchives.com. So anyway, folks, I'm going to raise a horn to our most exalted patrons, our friend Mr. Corey, and our very own Andre. Hail to them, and hail and many blessings to you guys, and many Yuletide blessings, man. Yule's coming up. I hope you guys have a wonderful, joyous, incredible Yuletide season. These past few years have been rough, man. Everybody's been struggling. Everybody's been having a tough time, and we got a bright future ahead. The darkness is going to start clearing up, and this is going to be a wonderful Yule. So my heart and my love and my blessings goes out to all the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens out there that tune in and follow us and all that kind of stuff. My heart and my soul and my love goes out to you guys, and I hope you guys have a wonderful, blessed Yuletide season. I'll see you guys very, very soon. Next episode of the Bog. I'm not sure when it's going to be. We might, if it lands on the holiday, we're going to take off. So if it does, we'll see you after that. All right, everybody. Hail.
It will apparently land on Christmas Eve.
Okay, so don't expect to see us there. We're going to be hanging out with our families. We don't work on holidays around here on the Bog. We don't do that. We're a union. So anyway, I'll see you guys next time. Hails and blessings.